Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Obama opens talks with African leaders at summit, and Ebola toll over 900 for suspected death in Saudi Arabia. I'm Bob Doty, reporting from Washington. U.S. President Barack Obama and African leaders have opened talks on expanding trade, improving security, and strengthening government accountability across Africa. In opening remarks Wednesday, Mr. Obama said, a new Africa is emerging.
I believe a new Africa is emerging, with some of the world's fastest growing economies, a growing middle class, and the youngest and fastest growing population on Earth. Africa will help shape the world as never before.
President said increased business opportunities in Africa could help transform the relationship between the U.S. and the African continent.
It's time for a new model of partnership between America and Africa, a partnership of equals that focuses on African capacity to solve problems and on Africa's capacity to grow.
Late Tuesday, the White House hosted a state dinner for the visitors where the president noted his African heritage and said that for his family, the bonds between the U.S. and Africa are deeply personal. Earlier, Mr. Obama announced $33 billion in U.S. private and public investment in various African countries. The Ebola outbreak showed new signs of spreading in Nigeria Wednesday, and Saudi Arabia is investigating the suspicious death of a man who traveled through West Africa. Nigeria's second confirmed victim of Ebola was a nurse who had treated a man gravely ill with Ebola last month. The Liberian-American man, Patrick Sawyer, Nigeria's first Ebola casualty, was hospitalized in Lagos after apparently contracting the deadly virus in Liberia. Saudi Arabia's official news agency reported that a suspected Ebola patient died in Jeddah on Wednesday, despite 2 days of intensive hospital treatment. The World Health Organization said Wednesday the overall toll from the outbreak centered in West Africa and has risen to 932 deaths from a total of more than 1,700 cases. NATO has warned that Russia could send troops to eastern Ukraine under the guise of a peacekeeping operation. We share the concern that Russia could use the pretext of a humanitarian or peacekeeping mission as an excuse to send troops into eastern Ukraine, a NATO spokesperson said Wednesday. A day earlier, the Western Military Alliance said Russia has significantly increased the number of troops on its border with Ukraine in recent days, bringing the total there to around 20,000, along with a large number of tanks, infantry, special forces, and aircraft. A fragile 72-hour ceasefire in the Gaza Strip held for a second day on Wednesday, as Israel and Hamas delegates prepare for talks in Cairo aimed at extending the truce. Ahead of the Egyptian-brokered talks, United States Secretary of State John Kerry told British media that the U.S. supports giving more freedom to Palestinians in Gaza. But he warned this must come with a greater responsibility towards Israel, which means giving up rockets, thousands of which Hamas has launched into Israel in the past few weeks. Hamas has been pushing for Israel to end the blockade that has strangled Gaza's economy and prevented Palestinians from leaving the crowded, impoverished enclave. A European space probe has ended a decade-long race across the solar system to become the first spacecraft to rendezvous with a comet. The European Space Agency's 1.7 billion Rosetta spacecraft entered into orbit 100 kilometers above the surface of the comet 67P early Wednesday morning, at a distance of more than 400 million kilometers from Earth. China says the death toll from Sunday's powerful earthquake in the southwestern province of Yunnan has risen sharply to 589. Rescuers have been busy pulling corpses from thousands of homes that collapsed following the 6.1 magnitude earthquake. Officials say 80,000 homes collapsed, leading to the displacement of at least 230,000 people. At least 2,400 people were injured. Rainstorms are still complicating search efforts and are preventing authorities from delivering badly needed aid to the mountainous remote area. The quake was centered in the rural county of Ludian, where many homes are poorly constructed using brick and mud. China says it is the worst earthquake to hit the area in 14 years. Southwestern China is frequently struck by earthquakes. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The Ebola outbreak has killed nearly 900 people in Guinea, Sierra Leone, Liberia, and now Nigeria. This is the first time West Africa has seen Ebola, and it's turning out to be the worst outbreak of the disease ever, in part because people either don't know what to do or are refusing to comply with public health recommendations. Experts say education may be more effective than enforcement.
That's Heather Murdoch reporting from Abuja. Details coming up.
Also in the news, the UN Refugee Agency reports thousands of refugees and asylum seekers in Libya are desperately seeking to leave the country.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Sierra Leone, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
The World Health Organization has updated its figures on the Ebola epidemic in West Africa. It says as of August 4th, there have been more than 1,700 cases and 932 deaths in Guinea, Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Nigeria. The WHO says there were 108 new cases of Ebola that were confirmed between August 2nd and 4th. Meanwhile, Nigerian officials say the country's second Ebola patient has died and confirmed that five more people have contracted the disease. Heather Murdoch reports from Abuja.
Officials say a nurse who treated Nigeria's first Ebola patient 2 weeks ago died Tuesday of the disease. The five other patients are now in isolation at a hospital in Lagos. They're all health workers that treated Patrick Sawyer, a Liberian-American who flew into Nigeria from Liberia with the disease and died on July 25th. Nigerian Minister of Health Onabuchi Chukwu says the government is establishing a 24-hour-a-day Ebola command center and trying to prepare hospitals around the country in case the disease continues to spread.
Beyond Lagos State, we need to work with each state government to establish isolation wards in readiness for any eventuality. We'll strengthen the one of Lagos State working with the Lagos State government, provide even additional space, even in Lagos.
Ebola has killed nearly 900 people this year in West Africa in an outbreak Doctors Without Borders has called unprecedented and absolutely out of control. Outside the two in Nigeria, all of the deaths have occurred in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. Health officials have warned the public to avoid direct contact with the blood or bodily fluids of Ebola patients. But their efforts have been hampered by a widespread distrust of doctors and hospitals and an insistence on traditional hands-on burial methods, all of which allow the Ebola virus to spread. The nurse that died yesterday was previously reported to have been a doctor. She is the first known Nigerian to have died from Ebola. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Abuja.
In Liberia, today marks the start of 3 days of fasting and prayer decreed by President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf as the country tries to contain an Ebola outbreak that affected 8 of 15 countries, including the capital. VOA West Africa correspondent Anne Look has more with reporting in Monrovia by Prince Collins.
May God help them. That was President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf's message to the nation Tuesday night.
Relying on his divine guidance for our survival as a nation, I call on all Liberians to observe 3 days of national fast and prayer, to seek God's face, to have mercy on us, and forgive our sins, and heal our land.
Liberians, she said, are to fast and pray from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. during these 3 days. The pronouncement has gotten mixed reactions in the capital, Monrovia, with some saying it shows just how desperate the situation has become, while others told VOA it's an important step to keep people calm and unified. Some had already heeded the president's call as of daylight Wednesday.
May the strong
and the strong.
About 700 people, some dressed in white, gathered here at the Abundant Life Church on the outskirts of Monrovia. Pastor Varney Yarwo was at the pulpit.
The nation will survive.
Hallelujah. Our country will emerge victorious over this incurable disease.
The Liberian Health Ministry says 94 people died of Ebola in the 7 days beginning July 27th, in what its latest report calls the Dark Week. Daily life has ground to a halt in much of Liberia. Police are protecting health workers and facilities as fear and frustration continue to breed hostility. The president has put non-essential government workers on mandatory leave, closed schools, and told citizens to avoid large public gatherings. That's all in the hope of reducing transmission of the disease, while health workers scramble to contain existing cases. Ebola is spread through contact with the bodily fluids of a sick person. There is no cure, but some people do survive with medical care. In neighboring Sierra Leone, considered the most dangerous zone of this regional outbreak, soldiers have deployed to the east to quarantine the most affected areas. The government's actions come amid reports that people there are not cooperating with efforts to isolate the sick and those who may have been exposed to the disease. Anne Look, VOA News, Dakar.
As Ebola virus outbreaks continue to spread in Sierra Leone, humanitarian agencies such as the International Rescue Committee, IRC, work to contain the disease and educate communities about how to prevent contamination. IRC Country Director Sophia Senesi says Ebola is spreading faster than efforts to contain it. He also said there is an urgent need for technical resources in addition to financial resources. Another major problem is that many are afraid to enter health facilities. As a result, family members with symptoms may not get the treatment they need. Senesi spoke with me about the IRC's efforts to contain Ebola and the urgent need for resources.
The current rate of transmission of the disease is faster than the efforts to contain it. The geographic spread of the outbreak in Sierra Leone is so fast. We now have it in 12 of the 14 chiefdoms. That means that the financial and technical resources that are required to contain the outbreak are huge. If all stakeholders, including the government, had invested 6 weeks ago, less money would have been required now. The challenge, however, now is to contain the disease, rely on significant financial investment to contain the disease in Kenema and Kailang, and prevent what's happening in these two districts from happening in the other 10 districts of the country where there have been positive cases. For this to happen, there needs to be the required resources, financial and material. There needs to be strengthening of coordination between different organizations and delegate responsibilities between the international technical staff, non-governmental organizations, and the Ministry of Health. Quality clinical case management is the cornerstone of Ebola control. International technical support can be given for quality clinical case management, but there is also a need for Sierra Leonean clinical staff, doctors and nurses to be part of this.
Are people afraid to seek treatment and testing at health facilities?
We are observing significant drops in utilization of health services. People are scared to go to health facilities because they are both worried about getting Ebola from health workers and also because of the many fears and rumors that health workers are injecting people with Ebola. Health workers are also being stigmatized, and some are labeled as Ebola nurses, hence the urgent need to meaningfully engage community members to try and restore confidence in the healthcare system. This will be difficult and will take time, but with all hands on deck, it is doable.
So what is the procedure when someone comes in and they are suspected of having the Ebola virus?
The procedure is they will be received by a health worker that will refer them to the appropriate technical laboratory technicians to do the testing. And with the testing also goes, you know, some counseling, and then, you know, they will be isolated in the observation ward.
Those people that do die from the Ebola virus, are the necessary precautions being taken in properly burying the body?
Definitely, yes, because the body is extremely contagious. So you actually have specialized burial team that disinfects the body, prepares the body for safe burial.
How many cases of Ebola are there right now in Sierra Leone?
According to MOH figures, total suspected cases to date is 505, and total confirmed cumulative deaths is 253. This is according to the Ministry of Health figures received as of the 5th of August.
Are there any travel restrictions at this time going into Sierra Leone and coming out of Sierra Leone?
No travel restrictions, but mechanisms have been put in place at the airport to screen passengers that are leaving and coming into the country.
So really, to sum up your biggest concerns right now, what you're looking at is, number one, containing the Ebola virus that is continuing to spread throughout Sierra Leone, and number two is your need for resources, doctors and nurses and medical technicians who can actually help with the treatment and the educating of the community about the spread of Ebola.
Currently, we're supporting the government efforts in Kenema and Kono District to train healthcare workers, to provide equipment and supplies, to support contact in tracing and surveillance, because we really have to cut the chain of infection. And it is through actually increasing our effort in surveillance and contact tracing.
That was International Rescue Committee Country Director Safia Senesi. He spoke with me from Freetown, Sierra Leone.
This is the final day of the U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit in Washington. Today, the U.S. State Department is hosting what's called the Leaders' Sessions. President Obama spoke at the opening of the first session, which focused on investing in Africa's future. However, Mr. Obama began by addressing the Ebola crisis in West Africa.
I want to begin by welcoming President Conde of Guinea and noting that two leaders were not able to join us. President Sirleaf of Liberia and President Koroma of Sierra Leone. We are grateful for the presence of their delegations, even as these countries are focused on a very difficult situation back home. And on behalf of all of us here today, our thoughts and prayers are those who've been affected by the Ebola outbreak, especially those who've lost loved ones. You know, the United States and our international partners will continue to do whatever we can to help our African partners respond to this crisis and to stand with the people of Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. In their histories, they've overcome great challenges, and they are drawing on that same spirit of strength and resilience today.
Mr. Obama told the leaders' session that a new Africa is emerging, with fast-growing economies, a rising middle class, and the youngest and fastest-growing population in the world.
Africa will help shape the world as never before. Moreover, Africa's progress is being led by Africans, including leaders represented here today. More governments are embracing economic reforms, attracting record levels of investment, gains in development, increasing agricultural production, declining rates of infectious diseases are being driven by African plans. African security forces and African peacekeepers are risking their lives to meet regional threats. A new generation of young Africans is making its voice heard. Africa's rise means opportunity for all of us, including the opportunity to transform the relationship between the United States and Africa.
The president outlined three areas of discussion at today's roundtable meeting with African leaders.
Number one, we have the opportunity to expand trade that creates jobs. The new trade deals and investments I announced yesterday are an important step. And today we can focus on what we can do as governments to accelerate that investment, economic and regulatory reforms, regional integration, and development so that growth is broad-based, especially among women who must be empowered for economies to truly flourish. Second, we have the opportunity to strengthen the governance upon which economic growth and free societies depend. Today, we can focus on the ingredients of progress, rule of law, open government, accountable and transparent institutions, strong civil societies, and respect for the universal human rights of all people. And finally, we have the opportunity to deepen our security cooperation against common threats.
That's President Obama speaking on the final day of the U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit in Washington.
Coming up on 20 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. The UN Refugee Agency reports thousands of refugees and asylum seekers in Libya are desperately seeking to leave the country. The UNHCR says it is deeply concerned about their safety as violence escalates. Lisa Schlein reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
Nearly 37,000 people are registered as refugees with the UNHCR in Tripoli and Benghazi. A spokeswoman for the UN Refugee Agency, Ariane Rumeri, says many of the refugees are living in areas heavily damaged by fighting and unable to move to safer areas because of the ongoing clashes.
In Tripoli alone, more than 150 people of Eritrean and Somali and other nationalities have been phoning our protection hotline, desperately seeking help with medicines and a safer place to stay. Among this group, we're particularly concerned about a number of unaccompanied minors as well. Of course, we're also receiving calls from many of the Syrians and Palestinians who are staying mainly around Benghazi, who are less affected by the fighting today, but also in need of dire assistance.
Since intense fighting erupted nearly 3 weeks ago in the capital Tripoli and in Libya's second city, Benghazi, the country has been slipping deeper into chaos. Thousands of terrified refugees, asylum seekers, and other foreign nationals who have been living in Libya for years are resorting to desperate measures to leave the country. Meanwhile, the smuggling trade is flourishing. The UNHCR says smugglers are preying upon the fears of thousands of desperate people who are risking their lives by taking the dangerous sea journey across the Mediterranean to Europe. Rumeri says the recent fighting around Tripoli has not stopped boats from leaving. She says departure points have simply moved away from the battle zone further east.
Now, more boats are now leaving from points such as Ahum and Benghazi. We recently heard of a group of 500 Syrians who've just left in about three boats towards Italy from Benghazi, and this is a new and much more dangerous journey because it takes longer to reach Italy. Over 1,000 people have died in the Mediterranean this year, and the latest casualties drowned last week off Ahum, which is about 100 kilometers east of Tripoli. The 128 victims were of mostly African nationalities and included many women and children.
The UNHCR reports thousands of people trying to flee Libya by land are being blocked by various travel restrictions. It is urging Libyan authorities to relax exit visa restrictions to allow people to leave. At the same time, the UN Refugee Agency is asking the governments of Egypt and Tunisia to keep their borders open to those fleeing violence and seeking international protection. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In Egypt, security officials say militants attacked a government checkpoint in the coastal province of Matruha last night and killed five policemen. Egypt's Interior Ministry says four gunmen also died when security forces from a nearby port pursued the attackers. Clashes between militants and Egypt's security forces continues as Islamists confront a government crackdown on the Muslim Brotherhood following the removal of President Mohamed Morsi. President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, a former general elected in June, promised to enforce greater security in a country racked by political protests since 2011. In other news, a Cairo court has handed down life sentences to three women who supported former President Morsi. They were convicted on charges of using force and weapons during violence after Mr. Morsi's ouster.
A member of Uganda's parliament says the anti-gay bill thrown out by a constitutional court in Kampala last week will be reintroduced. Abdul Latif Sebagala says he expects to have about 200 MP signatures today to bring the bill back for a vote. Supporters of the Anti-Homosexuality Act said they hope to have a new bill passed within 3 days. The reintroduction of an anti-gay bill in Uganda may trigger new international debate of the controversial legislation. The original bill proposed sentences of up to life in prison for those convicted of engaging in gay sex. It also allowed lengthy jail terms for those convicted of what it calls attempted homosexuality and promotion of homosexuality. Homosexuality is illegal in 37 African countries. The sentences in the Uganda law were among the harshest on the continent. Although the legislation has wide support in Uganda, it has been condemned in the West.
protecting young children from malaria in countries where the mosquito-borne illness is endemic can include preventative drug treatment during the rainy season when most infections occur. Now, researchers report that delivering an anti-malaria drug monthly all year long dramatically reduces the risk of this potentially lethal disease in infants and toddlers. VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
90% of the 219 million malaria cases each year occur in sub-Saharan Africa, where most of the disease's 660,000 fatalities are children. Infants and toddlers are at risk for the worst type of malaria, known as cerebral malaria, as well as life-threatening anemia and respiratory distress. Insecticide-treated bed nets have been the mainstay of prevention, but healthcare providers soon may be including a monthly dose of the artemisinin-derived drug known as DP in their arsenal to protect malaria's tiniest victims, children between the ages of 6 and 24 months. In a new study involving almost 400 children from Uganda, an international team of researchers discovered that a monthly dose of DP given to babies and toddlers reduced the risk of parasitic infection by 58% compared to children who received no treatment. Two other study drugs worked, but not as well. The trial took place in an area where the risk of infection is a year-round concern. Lynn Moffinson is chief of the Maternal and Pediatric Infectious Disease Branch at the U.S. National Institutes of Health, which helped fund the study.
The main message here is that prevention is better than waiting until the child gets sick and dies, and that in the absence of a vaccine and in areas with a high rates of resistance, this kind of intervention that the folks studied is important to consider.
The malaria parasite has developed resistance to the two less effective study drugs, say experts, and there had been concern that regular preventive treatments could render other drugs ineffective. But that did not happen as researchers sought to weigh the benefits of year-round treatment to the risks of anemia and other drug side effects. Investigators stopped administering DP and the other drugs at 24 months, following the children through age 3. At that age, Moffinson says, most young children develop some immunity to malaria.
The kids still get malaria, but it is not the severe kind of malaria that causes death that is seen in young infants.
Moffinson says researchers found the infants and toddlers who were given drugs preventatively each month had the same risk of malaria infection as other kids, indicating that the treatment had not compromised their immune response. The findings were published online in the open access journal PLOS Medicine. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi right here in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami. Thanks for joining us. We love to have you on board. This is Upfront on The Voice of America. Hot, hot.
Upfront is a show that explores issues
that affect your daily lives. Don't move that dial. Get your snacks, get your cup of tea or your cup of coffee. Put your feet up. This is Upfront. Cheers, cheers. Clink, clink.
Yeah, now there's the youth culture that is being practiced by the youth globally.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
I feel like the problem is that once the funds are sent
to these developing countries. It sometimes gets in the wrong hands, and then it's the actual people that are supposed to be benefiting from these funds really never even get to see.
What does this mean for your local culture? Is it being threatened? Should your parents be worried? Let's talk. This is Upfront of the Voice of America. You can follow me on Twitter. My handle is at Upfront Africa. And remember, you can always send us an email here on the show. It's upfront@voanews.com.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. And here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Nigerian officials say the country's second Ebola patient has died. The UN Refugee Agency reports thousands of refugees and asylum seekers in Libya are desperately seeking to leave the country. And President Barack Obama says a new Africa is emerging with fast-growing economies and a rising middle class. Coming up, music from Sierra Leone, and in our feature segment, the U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit. I'm Yehiz Wuhid, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. Hello, Sunny.
Hello, Yehiz.
Sunny, I understand you're beginning with a big basketball coaching move.
Yehiz, let's tip off with a trailblazing coaching hire in the National Basketball Association. The NBA champion San Antonio Spurs have announced that Becky Hammon, a 16-year veteran point guard in the Women's National Basketball Association, will join the team as an assistant coach for the 2014-2015 season. The 37-year-old Hammon is the first woman to be named a full-time assistant in NBA history. Talk to us, Becky!
I'm just incredibly grateful, obviously, to the Spurs organization and Coach Pop and RC and the whole staff, really, just from day one has been so great to me. I'm a little overwhelmed right now, to be perfectly honest. As great as it is, this opportunity, it's also incredibly humbling at the same time. So feeling a lot of emotions, but those would probably just be the two driving forces, is just thankful and just humbled.
Becky Hammon has played for the WNBA's San Antonio Stars Club since 2007. She says a knee injury suffered last season proved to be a blessing in disguise, as it allowed her to watch the Spurs practices.
My ACL injury last year, talk about flipping things around. I mean, that really was a huge turning point in the fact that it allowed me to be here. It allowed me to be in coaches' meetings with them, to be on the floor with them, to see how things really work behind the scenes. And he played a part in that. I know there was communication. I had went to him probably in July, late July and August, and I said, you know, since I'm going to be around, can you talk to, you know, RC and Pop and see if I, you know, they wouldn't let me into a few practices so I can kind of peek my head and learn from them. And that just kind of snowballed into, yeah, come on over. We'd love to show you the ropes a little bit and see how we do things over here.
That's Becky Hammon, the first woman to be named a full-time assistant coach in National Basketball Association history. Becky was speaking at a news conference in San Antonio, Texas. Hammon will finish up her season with the WNBA San Antonio Stars and then immediately move to the coaching staff of the defending NBA champion San Antonio Spurs. Joining us once again this evening from Johannesburg is our African football guru David Legg, who is ready to take a look at the recent Nations Cup qualifiers on the continent. And David kicks off with a road victory by Uganda in Mauritania.
A knock shot, it was Mauritania 0, Uganda 1. A goal from Sentongo in the second minute of stoppage time gave the Ugandan Cranes victory, and Uganda qualified 3-0 on aggregate. Big surprise, Sonny, in Nairobi. Kenya 0, Lesotho 0. So Lesotho qualify 1-0 on aggregate. Now, Kenya have not been doing particularly well in the Nations Cup. They last qualified in 2004. So why do I say it's a shock? Well, it's a shock because Lesotho's previous 11 away matches in Cup of Nations qualifiers were all lost, and they only managed to score one goal. That sounds very difficult, but it's true. One goal in 11 matches and all of them lost. But the brave Lukwena, which translated means the crocodiles, they held on in Nairobi, forced that goal to draw, and they go through. So well done to the people and the team from that little mountain kingdom in southern Africa of Lesotho. In Maputo, it was Mozambique 2, Tanzania 1. Josimar, in first half stoppage time, gave the Mozambican Mambas, and Mambas translated means the snakes, the lead. Tanzania equalized after 75 minutes through Samata. So with 15 minutes to go, Sonny, we had a situation where Tanzania needed a second goal. Otherwise, Mozambique were going to go through on the away goal rule. But there was no need for the pocket calculators because Palembe scored with 8 minutes left. So Mozambique qualified 4-3 on aggregate. Another very tight encounter at Blantyre in Malawi at the Kamuzu Stadium. Malawi 1, Benin 0. John Banda, with an acrobatic scissors kick, scored after 14 minutes. That was the only goal in regulation time, so the match finished 1-1 on aggregate. It went to penalties, and Malawi prevailed by 4-3. A surprise failure to convert his penalty was the Benin star, Stéphane Sessegnon, who plays for West Bromwich Albion in the English Premier League. And incidentally, he is the leading scorer after the knockout stage of the qualifiers with 4 goals. Another turn up in Kigali in Rwanda, the Rwandan Wasps 2, the Congo-Brazzaville Red Devils 0. 2-2 on aggregate, Rwanda qualified 4-3 on penalties. A great start, Sonny, to the career as Rwanda coach for Stephen Constantine. He's a 51-year-old Englishman. He's coached Malawi. He's coached Sudan. In Asia, he's coached India and Nepal. And he came to Rwanda from the beautiful Mediterranean island of Cyprus, where he had just helped the club gain promotion to the top flight of football. Now, in his first match in charge, Rwanda hammered Libya, the recent winners of the African Nations Championship, 3-0 in Kigali. And this was his second competitive home game. So far, so good for Stephen Constantine. Then, Sonny, in Bissau, we had Guinea-Bissau 1, Botswana 1. Botswana qualifying 3-1 on aggregate, but it was a very tense match for the visiting Botswana team. 2-0 up from the first leg, but they fell behind to a goal after 20 minutes, and it wasn't until stoppage time that they equalized. So a good result out for Botswana. The Seychelles Sierra Leone game, unfortunately, cancelled because of the Ebola crisis. So Sierra Leone qualify. Now, what that means is we now have finality as far as the composition of the groups. So let's look at these groups. Group A, Nigeria, the holders, South Africa, Sudan, and Rwanda. Group B, Mali, Algeria, Ethiopia, and Malawi. Group C, Burkina Faso, Angola, Gabon, and the little team from Lesotho. Group D, Ivory Coast, Cameroon, Democratic Republic of Congo, and Sierra Leone. A really tough group, that one. Group E, Ghana, Togo, Guinea, and Uganda. Group F, Zambia, the Cape Verde Islands, Niger, and Mozambique. And then, in my opinion, the group of death, Group G, Tunisia, Egypt, Senegal, and Botswana. And the match dates, Sonny, September 5 and 6, September 10, October 10 or 11, October 15, November 14 and 15, and November 19. The group winners and group runners-up qualify automatically for the finals, along with the host nation, Morocco. And then to get a 16th team, the best of the 7 third-place countries will also qualify for the finals.
Zambia making changes to their coaching staff. How about some details for our VOA listeners?
Yes, Sonny. Patrice Baumel, he's a 37-year-old Frenchman. He has quit as coach of the Zambia Chipolopolo, that's the Upper Bullets. As far as Kalusha Bwalya, the man in charge of Zambian football, is concerned, the reason is that Bomell wants to team up once again with Herve Renard. Now, as you've mentioned on a previous edition of the Sunny Side of Sport, Herve Renard is the new coach of the Ivory Coast Elephants. Renard, of course, the man in 2012 who led Zambia to a sensational victory in the Africa Cup of Nations. Patrice Bamel, by all accounts, Sonny, is going to join him in Abidjan.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
And when you visit VOAnews.com, make sure you check out the Sunny Side of Sports blog, in which I write about a variety of sporty topics. My latest blog post is titled Kenyan Javelin Thrower Julius Yego, who was recently crowned Commonwealth Games champion in Glasgow, Scotland. In fact, Julius is the first Kenyan to win a Commonwealth Games gold medal in the javelin. Yego's winning throw of 83.87 meters came in the third round of the javelin competition. The 25-year-old Kenyan decided to pass on his three remaining attempts because he was afraid he would aggravate a groin injury suffered during warm-ups. The track in Glasgow was slippery from pouring rain that made the competition challenging for Yego and all the javelin throwers. Julius has a stocky, powerful physique. He says as a young boy growing up in the Rift Valley region of Kenya, he gave up running and took up the javelin because he was so slow. To improve his technique, Yego studied YouTube videos of athletes like Czech great Jan Železny, the three-time Olympic champion and world record holder in the javelin. Yego has shown steady improvement in his throws over the past 5 years, and Kenyan officials recognized his hard work by naming him captain of the country's athletics team in Glasgow. After his Commonwealth Games gold medal, Julius Yego is now planning to defend his African javelin title next week in Marrakesh, Morocco. Follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny, and my Twitter handle is at VOA Sunny Sports. I'm pleased and proud to report that one of my newest Twitter followers is none other than Julius Yego, Kenya's African and Commonwealth champion in the javelin. If you want to follow Julius, his Twitter handle is at Julius Yego KE. Once again, at Julius Yego KE. And tell him Sonny sent you. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to you, Hayes Woohee.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Friday, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 17:30 UTC right here on The Voice of America. Coming up, the U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit. And next, the role of remittances play in Africa's economic growth. But first, some music. Here is Lady Felicia of Sierra Leone with African music.
Africa.
Lady Felicia of Sierra Leone with African music. The U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit is coming to a close. Scores of heads of states have attended. The focus of the summit was on security, business, and investment. But some NGOs say other important issues have been left out. Adam Shapiro is the head of campaigns for the human rights group called Frontline Defenders. He says that in June, a large group of African NGOs came together in Washington to devise recommendations to give the U.S. government and African heads of state. He talks about those recommendations with reporter William Eagle.
So the main, this fell into basically three broad areas of concern. One was the misrule of law, or the rule of law, and ultimately what is the misrule of law. One was the issue of marginalization of minority or groups. And then the third one had to do with good governance and transparency issues. So this group of African civil society representatives met in June and put together these recommendations, which are available at the website weareafrica.org. And on there, anyone can read the recommendations, and we have it available in a number of languages that are used on the continent. So it's widely accessible.
Wasn't one of these suggestions that U.S. government institutions like the Millennium Challenge Corporation accounts and AGOA, the African Growth and Opportunity Act, that they introduce certain eligibility requirements?
Yeah, there's a sense that these funds that are available, are being made available, are being done so in a way that doesn't take into account or provide enough monitoring for when there are abuses or when there is corruption involved, especially corruption is a big problem. And so what the recommendations are trying to get to is a point where, you know, there are conditions set from the outset and sort of benchmarks of I don't think that the recommendations really specified exactly what benchmarks should be there, but that's part of the process. These are sort of initial recommendations to begin a process of how to improve what currently in terms of investment or development aid for Africa. And then to take it to the next step would be to, you know, look at these recommendations, talk more with civil society, talk more with those institutions that are conducting this investment and development in Africa.
Do you see a recognition of the importance of human rights by the administration by not inviting to the summit three African leaders that have poor records, Robert Mugabe of Zimbabwe, Omar al-Bashir of Sudan, and Isaias Afwerki of Eritrea?
Well, Eritrea and the United States don't have diplomatic relations, so that, from a technical standpoint, makes things quite difficult to invite that head of state. In terms of Omar al-Bashir from Sudan, he, of course, has been indicted by the International Criminal Court, so were he to come to the United States, he would be potentially under threat of arrest, and the United States would have an obligation to arrest him. And, of course, Robert Mugabe faces sanctions initiated in part by the United States. So that also has legal implications. So I don't really see this as a recognition of human rights, because, of course, there are other heads of state who are coming, the leader of Equatorial Guinea. My understanding is that the new president of Egypt will be attending as well. And others, you know, who have less than stellar human rights records and about whom the United States government and State Department have certainly raised issues. I mean, the issue of human rights is not on the agenda at all in any formal way, and certainly not from what we're hearing, what the discussions will be about, that human rights isn't going to be explicitly brought up. So I don't think that this is really, the kind of summit that at the moment is the kind of summit that those of us in the NGO, in the civil society sector in the U.S., and especially our colleagues from the civil society sector in Africa, would expect to see from the United States. And certainly, I think it's fair to say from our friends on the continent that they had expected more from President Obama specifically. There have been previously, in the past year or so, other summits where African heads of state have been invited for the purposes of investment. China has held one. Japan has held one. India apparently has held one. Russia. In those summits, there was very low expectation from Africa that any kinds of issues around the governance or human rights or transparency or corruption would be brought up at those summits. But when it comes to the United States, there was an expectation, or there is an expectation, that these kinds of issues would be on the table. Unfortunately, we're not seeing that, and that is a source of grave, I think, disappointment.
That was Adam Shapiro of the human rights group called the Frontline Defenders. He was speaking with reporter William Eagle. A recent panel discussion organized by the Africa-America Institute on the role remittances play in Africa's economic growth has ended. Speaking from her New York office, the CEO of African American Institute, Kujan Kuju, stated, Africans send about $60 billion to the continent yearly, and that, she says, helps to further stimulate economic growth and development.
Well, I think, you know, the economic realities on the continent are very challenging. And so we have situations where the diaspora is really subsidizing, you know, the consumption of the economic activities on the continent. Particularly, you know, it's basically middle class Africans here sending money to either individuals who are less fortunate on the continent within their families to help pay for tuition, for medical bills, for health, you know, issues. So I think just the economic realities on the continent can be very challenging for a lot of people.
What do you think African governments and private institutions can do to help reduce the cost of remittances?
Well, that's one of the questions we're going to talk about, actually, because we're going to have a representative from an institution that is trying to bring the cost down. He's able to, you know, you're able to send money to Uganda, for example, at almost half the price of sending it through Western Union. This company doesn't have, you know, maybe the infrastructure that Western Union has, but, you know, so they're able to bring the cost down and still be reliable. So it's really a question of policy from the government. It's a question of more players entering the market and therefore reducing the price. I think that's going to be a very determining factor. If we can get more people to compete with Western Union, then it's going to bring the price down a lot.
Critics say that because Africans in the diaspora are so focused on contributing to the economic development of the continent, they're somewhat lagging behind in achieving meaningful developmental goals in their adopted homes as compared to other migrant groups. How would you react to that?
That's a really interesting observation. I think that people in the diaspora, we're struggling, right? Because we need to fund consumption because people have needs that are very dire. People have school that they have to pay for, medical bills that have to be paid for. And so there are these sort of day-to-day immediate needs that many people in the diaspora pay for on the continent. But then, as your question stated, there are these major structural achievements that have to be made in order for economic development to truly occur. And how many of us are participating in those major structural, sustainable, long-lasting activities that's really going to change the African continent around? And that's the question that I think, that's the other thing that we want to discuss this time, is what can we be doing other than sending grandma $200 every month? Could we be investing in bonds, you know, and other instruments that's going to go towards building the continent, the infrastructure of the continent, the educational system of the continent, the health you know, provisions on the continent? And so those are the things that we want to discuss at this event.
Amini Kajunju is the president and CEO of the Africa-America Institute. She was speaking with Odette Frezer from New York, New York. This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Werkinger, and our engineer, Nelson Lopez, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Freedom of religion is central to our national identity as Americans and a core objective of U.S. foreign policy. The right to believe in a religious creed or not, without fear of government interference, is essential to human dignity, robust civil society, and sustainable democracy. To promote these principles, every year our government compiles a report on the status of religious liberty around the world. It documents the actions of both governments that repress spiritual expression by their citizens and those that respect it. In its most recent findings, the U.S. State Department found that religious intolerance is on the rise in many nations, with interreligious and sectarian violence displacing millions of people and devastating communities. Government officials worldwide often act with impunity while violating the religious rights of their countrymen. Religious freedom is also impinged by the introduction of new restrictions, such as laws against perceived blasphemy and apostasy against mainstream faith. As in previous years, the government of Eritrea's record on religious freedom remains extremely poor, and the U.S. government has redesignated Eritrea as a country of particular concern because of severe violations of religious liberty there. Authorities continued to detain members of unregistered religious groups. That has been fueled by an increase in arrests of persons who refuse to participate in the new citizen militia program, as well as arrests of those who refuse to participate in the country's national service program on religious grounds. Other individuals have been harassed and detained for exercising their right to religious freedom, and there have been reports of forced recantations while imprisoned. Released prisoners report harsh detention and life-threatening conditions, including solitary confinement. Three persons detained for religious objections to military service reportedly died in custody during 2013. Religious freedom is a universal value. The freedom to profess and practice one's faith, to believe or not believe, or to change one's beliefs, is a birthright of every human being. Our nation will continue to shine a spotlight on violations of religious freedom in Eritrea and around the world, and will continue to promote this universal right as a moral and strategic imperative.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at voanews.com/editorials.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz and 15580 kilohertz. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.